Nobel Peace Prize. Michael Stipe, the singer, the songwriter, the activist, the jazz legend Wynton Marsalis, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Mossab Abu-Toha, the renowned playwright, hooray for the riffraff, and so many more. Go to democracynow.org for details and to get tickets. The seats are filling up fast. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. It's great to be back in cold New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
You could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a must.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Thank you. 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. 89.5 FM Bush Radio, the mother of community radio in Cape Town, South Africa. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York, and we are thrilled that our guest today is Dr. Jason Hanley from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Jason, thank you so much for coming on our program.
Yeah, thank you for asking me to be on. It's a real pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you. So the first thing we're going to talk about is that you're the Vice President of Education and Visitor Engagement at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Tell us about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and how you got involved with it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is an amazing place. It's located in Cleveland, Ohio, right on the shores of Lake Erie. And the museum actually opened all the way back in 1995. So we're celebrating over 30 years now of the museum. It's a fantastic place that celebrates the entire history of rock and roll. And we do that through exhibits where we collect, preserve, and exhibit all sorts of artifacts from the history of rock and roll that could be instruments that are performed, handwritten lyrics, stage costumes, all sorts of things connected to it. And we have educational programs, which is the area that I run. And we oversee everything from programs for toddlers and K through 12 students up through college and adult learning. We also get to put on a lot of great shows and concerts and interviews with artists. So I often say it's an incredible place to be because it takes this vibrant history of this music and it brings it to life and shows you the kind of power of rock and roll and what it has to really change the world.
And how did you get involved with it? Because we were speaking off the air, you have a long history of teaching music. And so how'd you get involved with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yeah, well, I'll make a little connection for you, too. I actually taught as an adjunct professor for a while at Hofstra University in the music department, where I taught everything from electronic music and 20th century art music and music history and music theory. And I was doing my PhD in musicology or music history at Stony Brook University, a little further out on Long Island in New York. And I always thought I was going to end up in a teaching gig, probably at a college or university. And I had done a lot of different things in my career. I had been in many bands and performed both on Long Island and up and down the East Coast and even a little bit further west. I had owned a small independent record label for a while called Transmission Records. I had been doing my PhD at Stony Brook, you know, studying the entire history of music, which you have to do to get a PhD. But my specialty was actually in a type of rock and roll called industrial. Some of your listeners may know bands there like Nine Inch Nails or Ministry or Skinny Puppy, some bands out of Europe like Einstürzende Neubauten in Germany or Throbbing Gristle in Europe, in England rather. So I was doing all this stuff, right? And I was kind of on the job market as I was finishing my dissertation, and I had been doing all this teaching at Stony Brook and Hofstra, and I saw this really amazing job posting for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. And they were looking for somebody who wanted to both teach educational programs, run the kind of community and live programming, and connect to people from all different backgrounds and talk about the history of music. And I thought, well, that's definitely something that seems up my alley. And I showed it to my wife and she said, okay, apply, let's get ready. And if you get it, we'll move to Cleveland. And within, I think about 2 months of applying for the job, I was packing my family up and moving here to Cleveland, Ohio. And I've been here over 21 years now, a great experience. And luckily I still get to teach in a lot of college programs connected here, both in Cleveland, and get to guest lecture in schools around the country. And it's been fantastic. You know, it's been a great opportunity. But a lot of what I had done in my career and my education in New York before that really helped lead up to what got me here.
I was going to ask about that education, because when I was looking into topics about music and I saw that you were a musicologist, I was like, what is a musicologist? And how do you, like, because a doctor of music, musicologist, you hear certain terms that people don't even know what it means. Break it down for us, what a musicologist is, and kind of that history of music that you studied, going back, I guess, from earlier days to today, and how we kind of, the through line.
Yeah, so musicology, it's funny, often if people don't know the field or the sort of study of music history, and they hear the word musicology, many people know the song by Prince called Musicology, which was a great record that he did that sort of had him looking back on his own musical history and influences. But musicology basically means the study of music history. And to do that, what you're going to be studying and learning as a musicologist is, how did music develop over time? What were the literal musical kind of building blocks and pieces of it that changed? You know, what makes Mozart different from Bach, and what makes, you know, Beethoven different from Little Richard, right? So you're thinking about some of the mechanics of music, but you're also learning the connections to cultural and societal pieces. So how did music function in society, right? It's something we can still think about today. If you think about artists who use their music for protest or to speak out on different topics, these things still have vibrant connections to our daily lives. So as a music historian, as a musicologist, you're going to go back and analyze the music. You're going to think about historical periods. You're going to try and make connections between different pieces of music or artists. You might study the creation side and how does a musician or a composer create a piece of music? How do they arrange it? How do they put it together? What chords are they using? You might also look at the reception side. How do people hear that music? And what is the sort of audience that's listening to it think about it? And what do they do with the music? What does it mean to them? So it's a really exciting field that covers a lot of ground. And, you know, I was saying I had to study everything. I mean, when you do a PhD in musicology, you're going all the way back to Gregorian chant and early music up through, you know, the Renaissance and Baroque and classical and romantic music in the 20th century, 21st century. But my interest had always kind of been in rock and roll. So I was studying it at a time where finally looking at popular music, it could be rock and roll or the kind of broader umbrella, anything from hip hop, soul music, heavy metal, that was just becoming kind of acceptable within the academy. So that you could study that for real and get a degree in it. So I was very lucky that that had just kind of opened up, and there were a number of great scholars doing that work before me that kind of led the way. So, you know, it was a good time to be studying that and letting me kind of connect up my passion and my background as a rock and roll performer myself into the study of history. The only musician I know very well who was from South Africa originally and now lives here in the United States is Trevor Rabin of the band Yes, who was a musician, grew up and lived in South Africa for many years.
Oh, wow. I know him, but I've never recalled the name. I should look more into it.
Yeah, his father and his family were big supporters of Nelson Mandela back in the day, too, and fighting against apartheid. So he has a kind of big history in South Africa before he came to first England and then the United States as a musician.
Jason, I'm curious if you could show, do you have any examples of like seeing through your study of musicology, the shared humanity of music with different audiences of different backgrounds all over the world? Do you have any examples of that?
Yeah, I think one of the great things about music is that people, it's an art form that you feel, that connects deeply. You know, I often joke, one of the great things about working at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is it's a museum where people come in, and you can go into an art museum, and I love art museums. I've been a big museum person myself and travel around the world to see them. But, you know, you might see a Picasso on the wall and appreciate the artwork, but you don't sort of have a personal memory of that Picasso of, you know, the way you might with music, you know, where you have a memory of driving across country, listening to a cassette tape with your best friend or the song that you heard playing when you fell in love. And people come into our museum, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with these personal, deep personal memories that connect them to the music. And what's great is seeing them then share those memories with other visitors or staff at the museum. And I think this is one of the great things that music can do in connecting people around the world and different cultures as well. You know, if you think about music from different places, I was introduced to a lot of fantastic African musicians through the work of Peter Gabriel, just because he loved groups like, you know, Ladysmith Black Mambazo or Yusuf Dunor. I didn't know those as names growing up in New York. But when I heard them on those records, I said, well, I have to find out what this is. I have to go learn more. And I'm sure the exact same is true if you take a musician in Africa, let's say Fela Kuti, who was listening back to a lot of rock and roll and jazz and things coming out of the United States and saying, this is amazing. How do I mix this with my local culture? You have heavy metal bands around the world inspired by American music. And then that music comes back and re-inspires people. So music is always in this period of cultural exchange where it's adapting and changing. And in fact, we were talking about my role as a historian or a musicologist and an educator. This is the stuff I love, of looking into, well, how did this music change when it went different places? And how did people add their unique sound and culture to it? And then maybe take that somewhere else and re-influence an entire new group of people. So I think, you know, I'm someone who's always listening for new sounds and new music. I've got my favorites. We all do, right? There's the record you're going to put on when you're just ready to have a nice relaxing evening, or you want to get pumped up and kind of get the day going. But I also try and listen to a lot of things I've never heard before, and it just continues to expand your horizon.
So now on my side, you know, everything is evolving. As some are saying that if something is not evolving, it dies. So with music, we've seen a lot of evolvement to a point where now some people, they say, old music was better and all that. What is your take on that when it comes to evolving of music?
I think you're absolutely right. I think music is always changing, and most art forms are always changing and adapting. Like you said, in many ways, the art forms can't stay static because they develop from personalities and the culture and the society in which the artist, the musician, the writer lives. So as they respond to the world around them and take in the world around them, the art itself has to be different. And I think one of the great things when you look, you know, at music history, and particularly, let's take rock and roll, since that's my kind of main thing. People are always saying that music used to be better and this new thing is kind of ruining music. In fact, that's what was said originally about rock and roll. You know, when it first got popular in the early 1950s, you had people saying that rock and roll was going to cause juvenile delinquency, that it would make criminals out of young people, that it was just a banging, loud, raucous sound, that it didn't have the intricacy and, you know, kind of complexity of music that had come before it, whether that be jazz or classical. And of course, people had knocked jazz as a kind of raucous music when it came out. And rock and roll connected with a lot of people and began to develop and change. It began to add different sounds. It built on, you know, African-American traditions. It built on traditions of Appalachian string music that came out of Irish folk ballads and British folk ballads. It combined all of these different sounds, and these hybrid musical forms created something totally new, you know. And it's by the time you get to something like the 1960s and the Beatles come along, well, you know, their first big hit in 1964 was I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is a pretty straightforward pop love song. But just a few years later, they're recording a record like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band that has some of the most kind of radical, innovative music of the time period. And you know, when hip hop first came out, people said that was noise and it was garbage. But look at all the incredible artwork and developments that have come out of that, not just in the United States, but around the world. Hip hop is one of the most powerful art forms out there right now. And in fact, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame here in Cleveland, we actually consider hip hop part of that larger umbrella of rock and roll. You know, I've had the good fortune in my job over the years. I keep learning myself because I get to work with so many great musicians, including a lot of our Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees. you take someone like Chuck D from Public Enemy or Daryl McDaniels from Run DMC, they know as much about rock and roll history as anyone because they've studied it, they've used that music, they've developed from it. They obviously also know hip-hop history, but they know rock and roll as well. So yeah, I think, you know, art forms are always going to change and people are always going to say this new stuff isn't any good and the old stuff was better. But inevitably, that cycle is going to repeat itself somewhere down the line.
Okay, so now, Jason, is that you've seen one of the greats, you know, doing amazing things, you know, in your lifetime. So now we, in future, you know, this is future, some are calling it the new world, and reality is artificial intelligence is here, and it's doing amazing things. At the same time, others are complaining about it. But now when it comes to art form, you know, music, as somebody, as an old school person like yourself who's seen the evolving of music or art, what do you think of AI in art or in music?
Yeah, that's a great question and a complicated question. And I think of myself as a, not just as a historian, but a musician and a composer myself. I've, you know, written a lot of music over the years and performed a lot of music. And I think technology is always pushing the world forward in different ways, sometimes for the better, sometimes not. But humanity has to continually grapple with the effects of the things that we create. And if you go back, you know, I'll pull out a bit of my historian chops again here and say, when music could first be recorded, Edison invents the phonograph, and we have the ability to record music and play it back without a performer. That was seen as radical. And many places, including the American Federation of Musicians, a union for performing musicians in the United States, said, well, this is it. This is the end of musicians performing live, because now that you can record anything, they'll just capture all the sound and you'll never hear a live musician performing again. It had the potential to do that, but of course we know it did not. People still see live music all over the world. There's something unique about it. When the drum machine or the synthesizer came out, people said, well, they'll never need real drummers or orchestral instruments again. It'll all be done through the synthesizer. Well, the synthesizer led to some incredible great innovations. Bands like Kraftwerk out of Germany or the Human League out of England, and got incorporated into many other styles of music eventually. So I think AI is a similar disruptor. And what's interesting about it is it's a tool. But because it is artificial intelligence, that tool and its impact is almost exponential, because it starts to suddenly feel like it is replacing the human ability to create and to do something. Now, look, you know, there's some AI artwork out there that is really great and very interesting. Something that's scary is the effect that AI video and deep fakes and things like that are having on our society, that are leading to, it's difficult to tell what is quote unquote real anymore sometimes versus what is artificial. It kind of makes me think of us living in this postmodern era in which we can no longer tell the real from the fabricated. All right, so what does all this mean for music? I think there's some really interesting tools for musicians to use AI to create different things in the way they mix music, in the way they develop it, maybe to create demos and to be able to hear something very quickly without having to put a bunch of musicians in a room to try something out. My gut tells me that it will eventually incorporate itself in different ways into the creative process that still involves live musicians. I think there may turn out to be music created only by a computer, but right now we can usually still tell it doesn't feel like it has a soul, right? If I may bring in a sort of a serial concept, there's something about real people writing music and the literal humanity of it that feels different than something created by computer. Now, who knows? That might change in the next 2, 5, 10, 20 years. But I think there's always a human element to something like music that is going to be there regardless of the way it's created. So it's an interesting time. I mean, I think it leads to a lot of potential dangers in society, but it also leads to some periods of maybe really interesting new creativity.
And Jason, kind of going off of that, you are, we've discussed that you're a music educator too. You teach me, you've taught music at universities, and you do a lot of educational programs in your work. How do you think AI in music, how do you think that's going to change the way that we teach music to young people?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, right now, a lot of colleges and universities and educational institutions are grappling with what do they do with AI, right? I mean, the worst case scenario and the most obvious situation is, you know, Ricky, you got a paper due at the end of this week and you didn't do it. And you plug the prompt from the professor into ChatGPT or your favorite, you know, AI, and it spits out the paper and you hand it in. Well, you know, that's obviously bad for a lot of reasons. One, mainly because you didn't do the work, but also because you didn't do the work. That doesn't teach you anything, right? When I teach in college classes, I say, look, AI is a tool. If you want to spit a prompt into an AI to help you kind of do some research or start thinking about something, that's okay. But you have to write the paper. You have to do the research. Also, right now, AI just accepts almost anything it sees out on the internet. So if somebody's got a really bad blog post that's just nonsense, AI might scrape that from the internet and use it in its response, even if it's not true. So there is some sense still that it's almost like media literacy. We have to learn to make sure that not everything we see out in the world these days is factual information or is real information, or, you know, what does that even mean? So, but I do think AI will start to transform certain aspects of education, particularly maybe in helping people find access to different things, to search through databases, to maybe even help, you know, students and professors with different types of kind of basic tasks that might allow them to spend more time on the creative or the research. So it'll take a little time, and there's going to be a push and pull back and forth. You know, the inevitable thing is AI is here, and it's probably here to stay at this point. Inevitably, we're going to have to figure out how to use it and live with it in a way that's beneficial to the human race, as opposed to, you know, creating a Terminator-like environment in which we're all worrying about when Skynet will take over and destroy the human race.
You mentioned in the beginning about the educational programs you do with your work at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Can you tell us about some of these educational programs that you do and the impact that it has on participants?
Yeah, the education programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum are, you know, I'll say I think they're fantastic. I love the fact that we teach across many different age groups. You know, we have a program called Toddler Rock that brings 3 to 5 year olds, mostly students who are involved in Head Start programs. And it's really a program that connects with these students to give them a developing background in numeracy, in literacy, in social skills. It's almost like a kindergarten preparedness program, but it happens through music. It's the one program we actually hire some outside educators to come work in. Most of my programs in the Rock Hall that my team runs are done by the team members who work there. But for this Toddler Rock program, we hire in music therapists who do an incredible job working with our curriculum and helping these students, you know, sing their alphabet, but learn all sorts of different things about numbers and letters through music and sound and performing together, which also creates a great sense of community for them. Then in the kindergarten through 12th grade, we have on-site programs that students come into the building, and we don't teach like how to play an instrument. It's not a school of rock where you learn guitar or drums. What we do is we teach about the impact of rock and roll. So we have a class that's on the history of hip hop, where we go back to the beginnings in New York City in the Bronx. And we talk about how hip hop started with MCs rapping and DJs scratching music on records. We tie that to developments in society, what was happening in the Bronx at that time in the 1970s that led to that. We have a great program called Fight the Power that takes a look at protest music and voices of change throughout the period from about the 1960s up till today. You know, the end of the class, we even ask students to think about their lives right now, what music is speaking out, protesting or talking about current events and issues. We also have a great program online. In fact, any of the listeners out there can log on. It's called Rock Hall EDU. And you can go onto the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame website and take a look at it. It's actually educational resources that teachers can use in their classroom anywhere around the world. In fact, we have users all over the globe who have accounts and log in. And there's everything from lesson plans to classroom activities to videos with some of our Rock Hall inductees and other artists talking about their music and history. And the idea is that you can bring these resources into a history class, into a science class, an English class, and talk about lyrics and lyrical development. Then we have college programs, too. I actually teach regularly in our community college here in Cleveland, the Cuyahoga Community College, better known as Tri-C. And we have a great history of rock program that I teach, and students come in and learn that there. But we also partner with many other institutions. I just did some programming with Baldwin Wallace University in their arts management program, talking about how do you manage artists and performance. And then we also do adult learning. So, you know, we have many, many programs where adults can come in and learn about the history of rock and roll. But that side of the programming also has things where it's kind of the really fun part of my job, where I get to interview musicians and inductees who come to Cleveland and ask them about their life and history and their music. We do film screenings. We do book events and book lectures. So as you can tell, it's a really exciting thing. And I always joke, there's never 2 days alike in my job. It's always something different going on. And our team also puts on all of the live concerts and music. So if you look at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame website, you'll see that we often do live shows, concerts, and you can purchase tickets, or even there's a bunch of them that are free, just free community events and programs. You know, we connect up. We have a great program in the summer called Fam Jam, where we actually let families come down to our front plaza out in front of the museum and enjoy live music and activities for families. And that's a free program that we do, too. So, yeah, it really captures a very broad range of students, from really young kids up to adults. It captures people from different communities. It involves different types of music, and I think that's what's exciting. And I every day is something new and interesting.
So now I want to know, you know, recently I saw there was the Grammy, the awards. Obviously, you on Rock and Hall of Fame. So I want to know, in terms of artist being awarded or being recognized, what impact that does to any art form, especially when it comes to if a person who does amazing being recognized, because there was even arguments that some of these awards are rigged and all that. Is not only about talent, but what is your take in terms of, you know, recognizing the greats of the greatest? Or do you feel like now it's not about really who's the greatest, it's all about everything is being rigged, in a sense?
right. Yeah, Kusi, thank you. That's a great question, right? I mean, I think particularly in the arts, when you say what is great art, it's hard a little bit. I said earlier that one of the amazing things about rock and roll is that it's so personal. So there might be an artist who, for me personally, is one of my favorites of all time. And if I said to you, hey, do you know this band? And you might say either, well, I've never heard of them, I can't stand them, or yeah, they're great, right? So it is subjective. You know, it's not like a Hall of Fame or an award where you're looking specifically at a statistical feature. You know, you might get something more like that in, let's say, a sports Hall of Fame. If a baseball player has just hit a record number of home runs, that's a number. You can say that is a great artist. With rock and roll, it's a little bit different. You might be able to say, well, this person had so many hit songs or number one songs or sold this many million records. That's an achievement, to be sure. And you mentioned something like the Grammy Awards, or something that honors people for a single year. you know, that could be great, but you might have an artist who has a sells a lot of records. But in the long term, you might say, well, their impact is not as significant. Vice versa. You might have an artist who does not sell very many records, but their cultural impact is massive. And I always use examples for that, like Jimi Hendrix. You know, I think everybody who knows rock and roll would probably say one of the greatest guitar players of all time, and maybe even outside of rock and roll, one of the greatest guitar players. But Jimi Hendrix only had like one hit song, and it wasn't even a song he wrote. It was a cover of the Bob Dylan song All Along the Watchtower. Or a band like the Velvet Underground, which basically we talk about as a kind of proto-punk band, a band that was, you know, mixing up the art scene in New York City and people like Andy Warhol and creating this abrasive music. It's become incredibly influential to many, 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 many musicians, but the Velvet Underground did not sell a lot of records. All right, this is a long windup to answer your question. So now, what you actually asked, so how do we determine for something like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? It is not an award for one good year, one good song, one good record. It is a lifetime achievement award. It's saying this person or this group achieved great things and literally changed the world around them. So how do you judge that? We look at a number of things. We always say that there's musical excellence. Were they great musicians? Even that can be a little subjective. You might take a band like Genesis and say, well, they're incredible performers and they're playing in different time signatures and different chord structures, and they have 20-minute long pieces of music that act almost like classical symphonies. But at the same time, you might say a great punk rock band like The Clash is musical excellence. They're playing far fewer chords in a much more aggressive style, but what they're doing there is incredible. We also look then not just at musical excellence, but the impact of that music. How does it influence other artists? Has it changed the way people thought about music? Has it done something innovative and, you know, really made people think about music in a new way? You know, if you think about the music of Aretha Franklin and the way she used gospel and jazz and brought that into soul music and completely innovated something new, or Ray Charles around the same time, well, that impact is massive. So many people who came after them were influenced by that. And then the third category we look at is kind of impact on the world in general. And you might think about that as somebody who has used their voice to make change, bring attention to different issues around the world. You think of a band like U2 and the work they've done to draw attention to the plight of people in different spaces around the world. Or you think of an artist who maybe is going to get involved in different causes so that the impact they have goes outside of just the music itself. That's what we look for. So, you know, when people say the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is rigged, often what they mean is you didn't pick a band I like. And I always tell people too, like, there's no chronology here. The band you like may still get in. There's a bunch of bands that I'm really excited about and I hope will be inducted one day. But there is a voting process. I'll tell you, I'm involved in it, so I see it happen. There's a nominating committee who looks at all the eligible artists. You have to have had a record out for over 25 years. That gives a little bit of historical perspective on things. And then the nominating committee creates a ballot, and it goes out to a bunch, to a large number, thousands at this point, of voters. And many people say, well, the voters don't know what they're talking about then. That's the problem. Well, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the majority of the voters are actually the people who are inducted. So if you like the band Metallica, or if you like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, or if you like Parliament Funkadelic, you know, all of these groups, the members who are still living, get a vote. So it is, there is an element of them being voted on by their peers, as well as scholars, journalists, music industry folks. So there is a process to it. And, you know, there's always going to be more artists who could be inducted than are, just because there's so many musicians around the world. And we often at the museum still celebrate many of those artists who are not inducted, but are still incredible musicians and made a big impact on the world of rock and roll.
I think that really touched on an interesting point, Jason, that art is subjective, and how even throughout the whole time we've really been talking about, you, me, and Kusi can all listen to the same song and all have a totally different takeaway from it. And that's kind of the power of music in the art form.
You're absolutely right, right? That's the thing that makes it so special and so unique, is that different people can experience music in completely divergent ways. But when you experience a piece of music with someone you know and you both like it, it creates this incredible bond, right? It's why when people go to a concert, everyone's kind of chanting and singing along and jumping up and down and dancing together, because they all have that connection through the music.
Even, I'm curious now also, you mentioned before the educational programs and kind of connections. The music therapists that come in, I never heard of a music therapist before this interview. I never heard of that.
Oh, yeah. It's a great field. In fact, there's a lot of places you can go to study music therapy, actually at colleges or universities. The idea of music therapy is, you know, if you think about it, there is this incredible ability music has to connect with us. I've been talking about it on and off, you know, throughout this entire session here. And I think when you connect that to some of the scientific pieces about how music affects the brain and connects to the brain, you know, there's incredible studies done with, you know, people who may be dealing with Alzheimer's, who are losing their memory or having trouble connecting to their own memories, but they can remember the words of a song from their teenage years. They can connect up and sing a melody. Well, we kind of use that in our program, Toddler Rock, by having the music therapist come in and use music as a teaching tool that's not just about learning something out of a book or whatever. It's connecting that emotional. If we ask students to learn numbers and have to sing it back, there's something in that activity that charges the brain in a different way. It also helps them remember it more. You know, they'll sing back a tune, or they'll sing back something they've learned through the program. And the music therapists we work with come from a number of different places. We've partnered with the Beck Center for the Arts here in Cleveland for many, many years. A great gentleman I've worked with over the years named Ed Gallagher runs that program and has been an incredible champion of it. We've worked with the University Hospital System, where there are music therapist. In fact, a woman who taught there named DeForia Lane was one of the originators of our Toddler Rock program, who helped us figure out how to build it in the first place over 20 years ago. So it's an incredible career and a way to think about how you can use music in a way to connect to people. And it might be young kids and it might be seniors and adults. And, you know, if you're someone who maybe needs help, look around. There may be a music therapy program that you can participate in as a patient, so to speak, to actually kind of connect to and gain some health benefits out of that musical connection.
And it's effective? Like, you've seen the direct impacts on people?
Yeah. In fact, one of the things we've often done at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is, because we're a nonprofit, we get a lot of great support from different funders. You know, a lot of our education programs are supported by things like PNC Bank or different foundations, the Cleveland Foundation here in Cleveland. So we do try and do some metrics, you know, not to get too nerdy on you here, but we try and look at a lot of our programs. What's the impact it has? We want to be able to say that. We want to look at those numbers. You know, it's not testing the way you often hear in education, where we're trying to put kids through terrible tests and, you know, withhold money or funding or different things like that. What we're trying to do is say, is this effective? Is this having an impact? So we did for many, many years, and we still do it occasionally, not every class, but we pre-test the students coming into a program on their knowledge base and their ability to do certain things. We then work with them through the program, and we test them again at several points throughout. And we have shown there's actual data that shows as they go through this program, they improve. In the case of the toddler program with the music therapist, they improve, again, things like their ability to count and to read and to know their letters and to spell basic words and all these things you need for kindergarten. At the K through 12 level, we see the impact that by learning through music history, there's also just like another fun piece of it that's less scientific, which is that if you're in a classroom and I'm trying to teach you about the economics of the Bronx in New York City in 1970, you might not be super engaged. But if I tell you, we're going to learn about that story through the way that Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five connected up to turntablism and hip hop and emceeing and rapping and breakdancing. Now, suddenly, you might become much more interested in that. And you're still learning about history, but you're doing it through this incredible lens of the vibrant musical cultures that came out of it.
Okay, so recently, I think beginning of last year, there was a concert which is called, I think it's a global concert, which is called World of Music, Arts and Dance, WOMAD. And So I was one of the MC for the show, and where I met like a great artist. One of my great takes from those artists, it was the guy called Ned Evert, who has a glass guitar. He's from LA. It was so interesting to see how many people are innovative, as you are touching on, that even if it's AI is here, there's still innovation on that. So now, the future of sound, you know, sound or frequency is always going to be there. What is your take on the future of sound? Just in general, just sound. It doesn't have to be specific song or any music, but just sound, because we are human beings, we're so associated with sound and frequency since eons. But now, the future of sound.
Well, Kusi, I have to go back and connect to that idea of the WOMAD Festival you mentioned, because I had talked a little bit earlier about Peter Gabriel, who's an incredible artist and one of my personal favorites. And he was one of the co-founders of the WOMAD, a World of Music, Arts and Dance Festival, back in 1982. Helped put together the first one and continued to be very involved. And for me, that was an incredible experience. And as I mentioned, it's how I learned a lot about different musicians around the world. And Peter Gabriel, in his work with Genesis and then as a solo artist, and even today, has always been very interested in different sounds, how people make them, how they combine them. I think that's even where, you know, when you mention someone like Ned Evert and the kind of that glass neck guitar that he's creating, which kind of, you know, my understanding is it works a little bit almost like an old resonator guitar, but a kind of modern version of that. Sound is always developing. It's always going to have different ways we can combine it together. I think it's one of the most exciting things about music. It's and every time you think, well, there's nothing new, there's nothing you're going to be able to do with it, then we get, you know, glitch music and people using digital distortion and the ways computers can chop up music to create something. You get people going back to ambient sound and recording, you know, as someone like Brian Eno did back in the 70s, recording the sounds of wind or sand moving and mixing that in. You get people doing different things with their voice or the body or creating new instruments. There's still brand new musical innovations happening out there. And even, you know, the way music is organized and put together, it's very different in different parts of the world. You know, the way in India you might organize the pitches and rhythms is very different than traditional Chinese music, or different from African musics in different countries throughout Africa. It's different throughout the entire continent of Africa. It's different in different places in the United States. So yeah, I'm always inspired. That's why I think there's always something a little bit different and new. Even the style of music I mentioned, I did my PhD on industrial music. That was about taking noise sounds and mechanical sounds and the sounds of people smashing, you know, a sledgehammer onto sheet metal. What did that sound like? And could that be used as the percussion part for a song? So, you know, sound development and sound design and how that connects up to film and television and multimedia. You even take some of the new ways people are experiencing sound in surround sound or in different sound environments, or the way headphones can give you spatial orientation. Yeah, I think there's just an entire world of things to be discovered out there. And for those listening who are interested in that, get to it. So there's a lot of good stuff still to be discovered.
But I think you mentioned this excellent point, Jason, about all over the world, the different styles we could be inspired by. There was a speech at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction this year from Cyndi Lauper, who ended very emotionally saying, "I still believe that rock and roll can save the world." And just kind of this idea we've been talking about how music can connect us, and we learn from each other and we grow. And I think that's just a beautiful kind of sentiment that you've shared with us the whole program, too.
Yeah. You know, it's really cool at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremonies, which happen every year, traditionally in either New York, Cleveland, or Los Angeles. And the artists who get up on stage take it very seriously and are able to talk about music and its impact. I remember when NWA got inducted and Ice Cube got up on stage and talked about rock and roll is a spirit and an attitude. It's something that's in us. It's a creative spirit, a way of thinking of the world and approaching it. I thought that was very powerful. And then, of course, you mentioned Cyndi Lauper, who this year, I mean, that was an incredible performance she gave in the inductions. You know, for those who are
interested. We are a community of light.
Yeah, right. Community of light. She had everybody hold their phones up. It's that same connection we were talking about, right? That they can, the audience can kind of become one. You can use that as a way to address, you know, social strife or different issues. You know, Cyndi Lauper has been a big advocate for the LGBTQ plus community, and she was able to speak out about that during that induction ceremony in a positive way. Again, about talking about caring for people and connecting with other people. And I just think that's one of the greatest things about music, about rock and roll. You know, yes, there are instances you could find where music can also be hateful and tear people apart, but I think that's in the minority compared to what most musicians are trying to do, which is bring people together.
Jason, I know it's time. Thank you very much for having time to speak to us. Obviously, we would have spoke more regarding on this issue. Thank you very much for being part of the show.
Yes, Ricky Cusi, thank you so much for having me on. And hey, you know, if anybody's traveling around the world and comes through Cleveland, Ohio, come visit us at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You'll have a great time and get to experience some of the things we talked about today in person. And I promise you won't be disappointed.
And Rock Hall EDU, people can experience the magic online, right? From all over the world.
Absolutely. No matter where you are, if you've got a computer, you can connect with us and connect with our education programs online.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you, Jason. You have been listening to the One Road Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, Cape Town, the mother of community radio. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens julle.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
And the hits just keep on coming.
Now radio. Prosperity, who uses a machete to cut through. Turn my world upside down, inside out, upside down. WRCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.